Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, colleagues. I welcome you to session MOAB1, TB and HIV, Still a Deadly Partnership. I'm Dr. Jerry Friedland from Yale University School of Medicine. My colleague Jose Miro from the Hospital Clinic at University of Barcelona will co-chair this session. I think that the issue of HIV and TB is as large as this auditorium, and I'm very excited that we have the opportunity actually to have an abstract-driven session on the intersection of these two extremely important epidemics. The first paper would be presented by Dr. J.H. Elliott and colleagues from Australia, Cambodia, and the United States, entitled Tuberculosis-Associated Immune Restoration Disease is Associated with Increased PPD-Specific T-Cell Responses Detected by a Whole Blood Interferon Gamma Release Assay.
Thank you, everyone. The aim of the study that I'm going to present today was to investigate immune reconstitution inflammatory syndrome, or IRIS, in a setting of high incidence of tuberculosis. In particular, its incidence, characteristics, and outcomes, its immunopathogenesis, and the performance characteristics of simple tests for diagnosis. We conducted a prospective single-site cohort study at the National Center for HIV/AIDS, Dermatology and STDs, Social Health Clinic, an ambulatory clinic in Phnom Penh, Cambodia. We enrolled antiretroviral-naive, HIV-positive adults and followed them for 24 weeks from the time of ART initiation. We, at pre-ART at weeks 4, 12, and 24, we performed the QuantiFERON TB Gold in-tube assay using the standard RD1 antigen, nil tube, and positive mitogen control with the addition of a tube containing PPD antigen. All the results were analyzed as continuous variables following the subtraction of the nil tube result. Pre-ART and at weeks 12 and 24, we also conducted skin testing using tuberculin, M. avian tuberculin, and Candida and trichophyton antigens as an energy panel. Today I'm presenting the results of preliminary analysis, including all participants who had completed follow-up by the 31st of December 2006. The case definitions for TB IRIS that were used in this study contributed towards and are completely consistent with those definitions recently proposed by the International Network for the Study of HIV-Associated IRIS. In particular, paradoxical TB IRIS is defined as the development of active TB using standard WHO definitions, a response to TB treatment followed by the initiation of ART, and the development of specified manifestations less than 3 months subsequently, with the exclusion of other causes. Incident TB on ART is defined as the initiation of ART following the exclusion of active TB and subsequently the development of active TB, with a subset of incident TB IRIS being that group in which specified manifestations develop less than 3 months following the initiation of ART. So the results, 54% of the cohort were male, the median age was 33 years, the baseline WHO stage was stage 3 or 4 in approximately 80% of participants. The median baseline CD4 count of 61, and 44% had a CD4 count of less than 50 prior to ART. There were 53 episodes of TB in 46 participants. In approximately 60% of participants, there was overlap between ART and the treatment of TB. 27 participants started ART during TB treatment, and 6 started TB treatment during ART. The site of TB in those that developed TB following enrollment in the clinic were roughly evenly split between pulmonary and extrapulmonary sites. And the pulmonary cases were split evenly between those that were smear positive and smear negative. 68% were treated as category 1 and 15% as category 2. So of the 155 participants who initiated ART, 27 or 17% started ART during TB treatment, and of these 6 or 22% developed paradoxical TB iris. And of these, 3 required no treatment, 2 were treated with prednisolone and 1 died. Of the 128 or 83% of participants who started ART not during TB treatment, 6 or 5% went on to develop incident TB on ART. In both univariate and multivariate analyses, paradoxical TB iris was associated with WHO stage 4 disease, and there's a trend towards an association with low baseline CD4 count and earlier initiation of ART. Restricting this analysis to the participants who started ART during TB treatment, there were trends towards association, again, with WHO stage 4 disease, a low baseline CD4 count, and earlier initiation of ART following the initiation of TB treatment. So in discussing the results of the analyses of the diagnostic tests, I'll first consider the group in which ART was initiated during the treatment of active TB. In this group, interferon gamma production in response to RD1 antigens was not different between the group that developed paradoxical TB iris and those that did not, either pre-ART or at weeks 4, 12 or 24. Interferon gamma production in response to PPD antigens, in contrast, increased in both groups, those who developed paradoxical TB iris and those who did not, but there was a more marked increase in the group, in the TB iris group, and at week 4, the difference between the groups were of borderline significantly different. Similar responses were seen with tuberculin skin testing, with increases in both groups, but no significant differences between the two groups at any time point. So now considering the group of participants who initiated ART not during the treatment of active tuberculosis. In response to RD1 antigens, interferon gamma production was significantly higher in the group who subsequently went on to develop incident TB on ART compared to those who did not pre-ART. At week 4 in this group, there was a significant increase in interferon gamma production in response to RD1 antigen, and a subsequent fall over weeks 12 and 24, but this remains significantly higher than the interferon gamma production seen in the group who did not develop TB on ART. In response to PPD antigens, interferon gamma production increased in both groups, but the increase was more marked in the group who developed TB on ART, and there was a significant difference between the two groups at weeks 12 and 24. Similar results were seen with the use of tuberculin skin testing, with again increase in both groups, but a more marked increase in the group with incident TB on ART, with significant difference between the two groups at weeks 12 and 24. So in conclusion, this study has shown an incidence of paradoxical TB iris of 22% in the first 6 months of ART when treatment was initiated during TB treatment, with trends towards association with WHO stage 4 disease, low baseline CD4 count, and earlier initiation of ART. Also shown an early rapid increase in interferon gamma production measured by QuantiFERON TB Gold in tube assay in participants with paradoxical TB iris in response to PPD but not RD1 antigens. There was also an association between the development of incident TB on ART and increased interferon gamma production measured by QuantiFERON TB Gold in tube assay in response to RD1 antigens pre-ART and in response to both RD1 antigens and PPD during early ART, and similar responses were seen with PPD skin testing. So these preliminary analyses suggest that whole blood interferon gamma release assays may have a role in the differentiation of paradoxical TB iris from other causes of clinical deterioration during early ART, and in the prediction and diagnosis of early incident TB on ART. I'd like to thank all the study participants, the Australian Agency for International Development who funded the study, my colleagues at the National Centre for HIV/AIDS Dermatology and STDs and the National Institute of Public Health in Cambodia, collaborators at the University of Western Australia, and my colleagues at the National Centre in HIV Epidemiology and Clinical Research at the University of New South Wales. Thank you.
Thank you. We have time for several questions. I'd like to actually ask a question about the one patient who died, mm-hmm. who was in the paradoxical or in the immune reconstitution group. Was that death thought to be due to immune reconstitution, or what? Because we always worry about, and immune reconstitution is very serious, but usually not fatal event, and yeah. always gets factored into the decision as to when to start because of the seriousness of it. And so was that an iris death?
Yeah, so I agree. I think that I would agree with Jerry that it's very important to understand that in most situations, the development of TB iris is not associated with mortality. In this specific case, the person had developed TB meningitis and then had a very rapid deterioration with death at another hospital, but was clearly documented as to be due to that meningitis and was so thought to be a manifestation of TB iris.
Questions? Please identify yourself and your institution.
Julian Andrew Carr from St. Vincent's here in Sydney. I suppose from a clinical perspective, that using a PPD assay like this, either to predict incident TB or to predict iris, you'd want to sort of try and determine what the positive and negative predictive values of the test are. Have you looked at that?
Yeah, perhaps if I can go to the slides. I've just got one indicative example of the analysis. I think it's important to realize this is a preliminary analysis and the number of cases are relatively low. Once we have the final data set, then we'll, of course, be doing all those analyses, looking at both paradoxical TB iris and incident TB on ART. As an example, in the group who are developing TB, it'll take too long to flick through, but at month one, in the group who had no active TB at the time of initiation of ART, then the performance characteristics of the QuantiFERON TB Gold using RD1 antigen tube performed quite well. So the sensitivity was perfect, the specificity was around 97%, and predictive values, again, were quite high. So I think at this point, with this preliminary analysis, there's at least the suggestion that these tests may be useful in the diagnosis either of paradoxical TB iris or incident TB on ART.
Thank you. Question?
Manuel Badegay, Basel, Switzerland. How early was ART initiated in the six who had iris and in the other ones who didn't had? Was that within days or weeks of tuberculosis treatment?
So overall, the median time between initiation of TB treatment and initiation of ART was around 60 days. In the group who developed TB, paradoxical TB iris, that value was slightly less, but as I showed in the analyses, there was a trend towards that association, but it was not statistically significantly different. If you look at just the raw numbers, four of those six had initiated ART within the first 8 weeks, and two had initiated ART sometime afterwards.
I have a question for you. In order to study the T-cell specific immune responses against Mycobacterium tuberculosis, what do you recommend, to use the PPD antigens or the RD1 antigens? Because also in a previous French study published this year in the journal, the Brigitte Autran collaborators did not find any type of specific response against the two antigens CFP10 and the
SAT6. Yeah, so I think at this stage our understanding of the pathogenesis of TB iris is, I think everyone would agree, quite limited. And so in the design of cohort studies, I think we should include as much robust immunology as we can, and we should use all available techniques and antigens to study both groups. I think that, as you mentioned, our results are consistent with what Brigitte Autran's group had shown, that in the paradoxical TB iris group, that the interferon gamma response is predominantly seen in response to PPD antigen and not to the RD1 antigens such as ESAT6 and CFP10. And so I think in the study of that group, then obviously we need to dissect further out what are the specific components of the PPD that are precipitating that response. In the other group, in the group that are developing TB on ART, I think we need a lot more work to dissect out the different subgroups. I think most of us feel that there's a large subgroup that is actually a form of iris. And I think that these results tend to support that, in that the responses that we're seeing in response to the RD1 antigens are quite different to what is being beginning to be reported in patients with TB who are followed during TB treatment. Again, the literature is reasonably inconsistent, but in the in use of the QuantiFERON TB Gold test, in general, during TB treatment, there's a reasonably stable level of response, of interferon gamma response. Although there's a bit of noise, there's a lot of variation during that. And I think Madhu Pai published that recently from a cohort in India. What we're seeing here is a much more consistent response. We see very high levels initially and then a tailing off. So I think that tends to suggest that the group, at least a large proportion of this group of developing TB during early AD, there's a large component of the immune response that's involved with that. Now, whether that's an association, it's not cause and effect, and whether this is TB that would have developed otherwise and you're seeing a robust immune response because of the ART, or vice versa, you're getting a robust immune response and therefore developing the clinical manifestation, we need much more research to show.
Thank you, Julian, for an excellent presentation.
Thank you.
Next paper will be presented by Dr. Avihing Sanon and colleagues from Thailand and the Netherlands. 24-week efficacy and safety of nevirapine, 400 milligrams versus 600 milligram based heart in HIV-infected patients with active TB receiving rifampicin.
Okay. Good morning. I would like to thank the organizations to allow me to present this study on behalf of my colleague. Rifampicin is a strong inducer of hepatic cytochrome P450. The combinations of ARV and rifampicin that can be used together is limited. Efavirenz-based regimen is preferred in concomitant with rifampicin. In case of efavirenz, allergy, toxicity, pregnancy, or unavailability. However, nevirapine can be an alternative option. Nevirapine fixed dose combinations with 2 NRTI are widely used in resource-limited settings where TB is common. In concomitant with rifampicin, nevirapine levels are reduced by 20 to 50%. Whether there is a need of a dose increase of nevirapine when concomitantly with rifampicin is unknown, especially in Thai populations where nevirapine pharmacokinetics is higher than Caucasian. Applying a higher dose of nevirapine may prevent the occurrence of subtherapeutic nevirapine levels, but may also induce more liver toxicity. Because of pharmacokinetic interactions, the appropriate dose of nevirapine is unclear. Randomized clinical trial looking into optimal dosings of nevirapine in these populations are lacking. While we would like to investigate whether in rifampicin-treated patients, nevirapine has to be increased to 600 mg per day. And to assess whether nevirapine 200 mg QD is appropriate during the first 2 weeks lead-in period, and to assess the safety and tolerability of nevirapine concomitant with rifampicin. So this study is prospective randomized multicenter in 5 sites in Bangkok, Phnom Penh, and Chiang Rai in Thailand. Our populations were HIV ARV naive, TB smear positive, CD4 less than 200, and taking rifampicin containing anti-tuberculosis for 2 to 6 weeks. These patients were randomized to receive nevirapine 400 mg per day as a standard dose and a higher dose of nevirapine at 600 mg per day. The backbones were ACT and 3TC, so we used the fixed dose combinations, ACT to 50 mg and plus 3TC and nevirapine as a BID dose. During the 14 days, we did the lead-in both groups. So first group lead in with nevirapine 200 mg QD, and the second group lead in with nevirapine 200 mg BID. The baseline characteristics were comparable between two groups, but you can see that they were very advanced patients with low CD4 and high viral load. Majority of them presented with dismissed tuberculosis followed by the pulmonary TB, and they have low hemoglobin at the baseline. The nevirapine minimum concentrations at week 2, week 4, and week 12. The blue color show the nevirapine standard dose, 400 milligram per day, and the red triangle show the nevirapine 600 milligram per day. As you can see, that the level in arm 1 is significantly lower when compared to arm 2 at week 2, and the level was increased at week 4 was still lower than arm 2, and the level was comparable at week 12. And you can see that the nevirapine 600 milligram have higher level since week 2 until week 12. About 80% of patients in arm 1 has suboptimal therapeutic level of nevirapine when compared to arm 2. This is during the lead-in period. And after lead-in period, at week 4 and week 12, the proportions were comparable. We have two case deaths, one from dismissed MAC and one from heart failure, and have 25% of patients developed severe anemia required by transfusion during the first 3 months. I also have about 30% developed immune recovery syndrome. Nevirapine hypersensitivity occurred in 25% versus in 6% in arm 1. So it's higher in arm 2. The TB lymphadenitis was the most common TB IRS. We have one serious case with pericardial effusions and require emergency drainage. The ALT change were comparable between two groups, but it's trending towards higher in group 2. In group 2, we have more cases with hepatitis C co-infections and higher ALT as baseline. So for the liver function test, grade 2 have only two cases, one from group 1 and one from group 2. From both of them were hepatitis B and hepatitis C co-infection. Look at the hemoglobin improves over time after treatment of tuberculosis and HIV. The viral efficacy, about 60% of patients had viral loss less than 60 copy by intention to treat analysis. And 80% in arm 1 and 100% in arm 2 had viral loss less than 60 copy at 24 weeks. The CD4 response is tended to have a higher CD4 response in arm 1, about 100 cell, versus 40 cell in arm 2. In nevirapine rifampicin concomitantly treated patients, up to 80% of patients in nevirapine standard dose has suboptimal level at 2 weeks during the lead-in period. Nevirapine 200 mg BID lead-in was associated with a higher risk of nevirapine hypersensitivity. Based on this small sample size study at 24 weeks by intention to treat and at treated analysis, the viral efficacy was similar between two groups. IIS found in 1/3 patients when heart was commenced within 2 to 6 weeks of tuberculosis treatment. The cytarabine-based regimen in early first 3 months of tuberculosis of HIV-TB patients associated with higher risk of transfusions required anemia. So Nevarpin sequence milligram or higher dose Nevarpin is not recommended due to higher risk of Nevarpin associated hypersensitivity. Although up to 80% of patients in the standard dose group has suboptimal level at 2 weeks after the lead-in period. Our recent 60-week study by Dr. Manoj Sheth from Bambaratnaradun Institute compared between 70 patients with rifampicin and 70 patients without rifampicin has shown that the nevirapine 400 mg per day may be sufficient for most Thai-HIV infected patients receiving rifampicin. Based on this preliminary data analysis, the SMB suggested that the nevirapine higher dose should not be further investigated. So our study was premature terminated. Our limitations were small sample size and short-term follow-up, and nevirapine may have inter-subject variability. And does this data apply to patients with high BMI or any ethnicity? And finally, I would like to thank you for all my colleagues to have great contributors to this study. Thank you.
Thank you. I have a question. I noticed that there was a high rate of study discontinuation among the patients. And was that largely related to the AZT anemia, or is that actually due to the hypersensitivity or other nevirapine type associations? And was there a difference in the discontinuation rate between the high and lower doses?
Yeah, so we have four cases with nevirapine hypersensitivity in higher dose and one in lower dose. And these patients were discontinued from the study. And one died from each group. I also have a culture comeback to be met. So we cut off the from the analysis. And also, yeah. Let's see.
We have questions? I was glad to see that your final point in which you at least raised the question as to whether differences in BMI and ethnicity might actually, how generalizable this is. I'm thinking of the presenter and the co-chair and wondering whether if we could save dose of nevirapine, we would actually have similar levels.
Yeah. So actually in Thai population, they tend to have a higher level of nevirapine when we look at the 2NN data. It's higher than Caucasians, so higher than in any ethnic city. So why we have quite higher nevirapine level? And I think it's based on this study. So if we start with higher dose, we face off the high incidence of toxicity. But if we start with lower dose, with 200 mg QD at the beginning, we will face off the suboptimal levels. So we have to balance between risk and the risk of resistance. But I would say that maybe we could go with just only 1 week lead-in instead of 2 week lead-in and no further for nevirapine 600 mg. But this may be just apply for only Thai populations. I'm not sure for others.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Altis?
Rick Altis from the U.S. I think you began to answer part of my question, but when you have 83% of your subjects who have a relatively suboptimal dose of nevirapine during the first couple of weeks and it seems to normalize, a couple of questions would be raised. One, do you have any sort of genotypic resistance mutations at 24 weeks, which is relatively short, you have similar efficacy. However, you know, are those folks on their way towards failure at a later point because of genotypic resistance mutations? And second of all, is there not a potentially different approach that you might consider as part of the next study in terms of what dose you use as part of the lead-in dose of nevirapine?
Yeah, for the genotypic resistant, we have in only one patient, but that patient, his adherence was very poor, and we cannot see any mutations, even with NRTI. And all patients are doing fine right now, and even the patients who switched from neuropine to efavirenz after neuropine hypersensitivity, so they still undetectable with efavirenz regimen.
But what about the ones who are not detectable?
That one, we did the resistant testing, but we cannot find any major mutations. So, but we're thinking about that he is taking ARV or not, because ARV level is still high and cannot detect the mutation.
Thank you very much.
We will move to the next presentation. The title is TB co-infection treated at onset of therapy does not affect long-term risk of treatment failure among HIV-1 infected patients initiating efavirenz-based combination antiretroviral therapy. The presenter is Dr. Ketan Patel on behalf of Indian and United States investigators.
Good morning, everybody. Today I am presenting our data on TB co-infection treated at the onset of therapy doesn't affect the long-term risk of treatment failure among HIV-infected patients initiating efavirenz-based combination antiretroviral therapy. As you all know, still TB continued to be one of the commonest infection in HIV-infected patients in developing countries. Rifampicin, a key component of anti-TB treatment, has significant drug interactions. Along with an NRTI and protease inhibitor. It reduces the exposure to efavirenz by 20%, which is more marked in individual with higher body weight. We previously reported in J-AIDS 2004 that HIV-TB co-infection can be treated by co-administration of rifampicin with efavirenz-based combination ART without compromising antiretroviral efficacy. Mansoodi et al. Reported in AIDS 2005 that median plasma efavirenz level were comparable among the patients receiving efavirenz 600 and 800 milligram with rifampicin. And Pedro Sampio et al. In his study reported that increasing dose of efavirenz to 800 milligram while using rifampicin is not necessary and may be associated with increased side effects. Rifampicin-based TB treatment at the onset of combination ART may have a negative implication despite initial successful immune reconstitutions. So main aim of the study, our study, was to study impact of TB treatment on long-term response to efavirenz-based combination ART. It was a prospective observational longitudinal cohort study of HIV-1-infected antiretroviral naive patients starting on efavirenz 600 milligram base combination ART along with 2 NRTI. Study was conducted at Infectious Disease Clinic, Ahmedabad, India, which is a tertiary care HIV clinic. Patients with minimum 12 months of follow-up were included in our analysis. Those with tuberculosis received 9 months of rifampicin containing anti-TB treatment in addition to combination ART, while those without tuberculosis received only efavirenz-based combination ART. And after 9 months, all patients continued to receive efavirenz-based combination ART alone. All patients were evaluated clinically monthly or more frequently till stabilization and thereafter every 3 months. CD4 cell count was carried out every 3 months. Baseline characteristics were noted. Patients were closely followed up for any drug interactions and treatment failure was defined as immunological failure. Various data were analyzed using chi-square and t-test, and statistical analysis was carried out using GBState version 7.0 software. Total 383 subjects had a follow-up of more than 12 months on efavirenz-based combination ART, of which nearly 51% of patients were TB co-infected, and nearly 49% of the patients were not TB co-infected. So, number of patients in each group were nearly similar. This is the table showing the baseline characteristic in each group. You can see the age, the sex distribution, and median weight in both TB and non-TB group were comparable. However, the baseline CD4 count was a bit lower in patients with tuberculosis, and than patients without tuberculosis, and difference was statistically significant between these two groups. But at the end of 9 months, that is at the end of TB treatment, the difference between these two groups, as far as CD4 count is concerned, was not statistically significant. This is a graph showing the CD4 response at various time points in each group. The blue line represents those patients without tuberculosis, and the black line represents those patients with tuberculosis. And below, we have given the numbers of the patient at each time point. And you can see the number of patients in each group at each time point are nearly equal, and the both lines are going fairly parallel. And there was no significant difference except few hitches in patient with tuberculosis. And overall statistical analysis was performed, and long-range tests don't show any significant difference as far as the rise of CD4 count between both groups is concerned. If you look at the adherence data, nearly 62% of patients in TB group and 65% of patients in non-TB group had a regular follow-up. 31 patients in TB group and nearly 30 patients in non-TB group had an irregular follow-up, and nearly 6-7% of patients in TB group and 4% of patients in non-TB group were lost to follow-up. Overall adherence when compared between these two groups was comparable, and there was no statistically significant difference was found. Later on, treatment was changed to nevirapine-based regime in 7 patients in TB group and 2 patients in non-TB group because of financial reasons. Now come up to treatment failure data. At the end of, during this 3-year follow-up, nearly 12% of patients in TB group had a failure to treatment, while 10% of patients in non-TB group had a failure to treatment. And overall, the difference between these two groups, as far as failure was concerned, was not statistically significant. If we consider all our lost patients as a failure, even then, nearly 18% and 14% in TB and non-TB group had a failure, and the difference was not statistically significant even then also. So as far as failure was concerned, the both groups were comparable. This is the table showing time to failure in each group. And you can see at each point of time, number of patients failing to the regime are nearly same, and there was no difference as far as number of failure is concerned. This is a table showing adverse reaction occurring in each group of patients. And you can see only hepatitis, which was more common in TB group and seen in 13% of patients as compared to non-TB group, where incidence of hepatitis was nearly 2%. Hepatitis in TB group was managed by discontinuation of hepatotoxic drug, and none of the patients in both the groups required discontinuation of efavirenz-based combination ART, and patients improved by treating conservatively. Other side effects like GI disturbances, CNS disturbances, skin rash, peripheral neuropathy, gynecomastia were comparable in the both the groups, and there was no statistically significant difference was found. Immune reconstitution was seen in nearly 15% of patients in TB group and 9% of patients in non-TB group, and the difference was not significant. None of the patients in TB group had a relapse while on combination ART, and none of the patients in non-TB group developed tuberculosis while on combination ART. So in conclusion, rifampicin-based TB treatment at the onset of efavirenz-based combination ART didn't predict or increase the risk of efavirenz-based treatment failure among the HIV-infected patients up to 3 years of follow-up. However, our studies have certain limitation. One was selection bias. We have only selected patients completing 12 months of therapy. Treatment failure was defined by immunological failure only. We don't have any viral load data, and we have not conducted viral load in our patients. So thank you very much for kind listening.
This presentation is open for discussion. Can you explain, please, that the reasons of the treatment failure all were immunological reasons, or there were another ones?
We have not done viral load in any of the patients, and all the patients who have failed in our study all had immunological failure with clinical failure.
And do you define the immunological failure?
Immunological failure was persistently decreasing CD4 count with change of more than 30% in absolute term, or with or without development of clinical symptoms suggestive of failure.
Other questions?
Question. Could you define the clinical status of the TB patients at entry? You mentioned there may have been some selection bias, and I saw that the CD4 counts were low, but did they have extra pulmonary disease? Did they have very serious tuberculosis where you would expect the outcome, even with antiretroviral therapy, might be problematic?
Yeah. Nearly 48% of our patient had lymph node tuberculosis at the onset, and nearly 20% of our patient had pulmonary tuberculosis. 7 to 8% of our patient had miliary with disseminations, and 2 to 4% of our patients had tuberculous meningitis, and 1% of our patient had meningitis with tuberculoma. So this was the rough distribution of our patient with tuberculosis.
Mark Boyd, Australia. Can you comment a little, Doctor, on the people that were lost to follow-up? It seemed like, particularly over the 2 years, there was a substantial loss to follow-up in your cohort.
Yeah.
What efforts were made, if any, to try and actually find out what happened to them and whether they in fact died?
No.
That's not possible.
Yeah. Our is a tertiary care center, and we are getting patients who are coming too far. They are coming from 200 or 300 mile away from their houses to our clinic, and we don't have follow-up data, what happened to that patients. They are taking medicines regularly, not taking, or whether they are alive or they are died, or what happens to that, we don't have any data regarding that. And as our patients are coming too far and they don't have any facilities or phone or any other things by which we can contact him, so it's very difficult in our settings to comment regarding your questions.
So if I may just ask, so how is adherence then measured in these patients if they were, I understand the long-term follow-up, but how did they attend clinic if they lived so far away? And what were the measures of adherence?
Generally, we call our patients after initial settlement. Patients come every 3 months, and most of the patients of our patients are coming every 3 months. Some patients which are irregularly follow-up, they come after 5 or 6 months, but they are taking regular medicines, and this was reflected in CD4 count and recovery as far as tuberculosis was concerned.
But was the TB meds administered by directly observed therapy?
No, it was not directly observed therapy.
Is there a question?
Yeah. Morning. I'm a fellow from Singapore. Just two questions. One, I noticed that you use 9 months TB therapy in your study. I was just wondering whether there's any particular factors which made you all decide to treat for 9 months rather than 6 months. Which
generally, it is our policy at our clinic that most of the patients are severely immunosuppressed patients, and number of patients have extra pulmonary tuberculosis are very too high. So it's our policy at our clinic that we use in all these patients and all the patients 9 months of anti-tuberculosis therapy.
The second question that I have, if I may, is a scenario which you see not uncommonly is a patient with an AFP positive, and we're unable to differentiate between disseminated TB and MAC. And sometimes in that scenario, we initiate them on clarithromycin and ethambutol in addition to standard TB medications.
Yeah.
Does your center have any concerns about possible drug interactions between clarithromycin and the antiretroviral regimens?
Probably we have not come across any case of MAC up till now. So regarding your questions, we are not using clarithromycin routinely in our practice. And regarding diagnosis of MAC is concerned, we have not come across any patients who is diagnosed to have a MAC infection.
Okay, thank you.
Last question, a short question and a short answer, please.
Okay. I am Dr. Vijay Bhaskar Reddy Kandula. I am from India. Is the 9 month treatment recommended by the National TB program, or is it a recommendation from any of the publications or what?
No, recently I think I had gone through a one publication in which it was I forgot the name of journal, but it was told that in immunosuppressed patients with extrapulmonary tuberculosis, 9-month treatment is recommended. But I previously we are using, because of immunosuppressions and advanced disease and extrapulmonary tuberculosis, this was the only reason why we are using 9-month TTB treatment.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks.
Next presentation is incidence of subtherapeutic tuberculosis drug concentrations and associated treatment outcomes among predominantly HIV-infected tuberculosis patients in Botswana. The presenter is Dr. Chideya from U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention and Botusa Project. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Tuberculosis, or TB, is a life-threatening but curable disease caused by Mycobacterium tuberculosis, and is the leading cause of death among people living with AIDS worldwide. Chemotherapy for TB has been in use since 1946, and current treatment regimens include isoniazid, rifampin, ethambutol, and pyrazinamide as the basis of most therapies. Yet despite their importance in defining treatment schedules, pharmacokinetic profiles of these medications have typically been established on healthy adults. Lower than expected levels of TB drugs have been reported worldwide and associated with gastrointestinal illnesses, drug-drug interactions, patient demographics, and HIV infection, to name a few. Potential sequelae of low TB drug levels include poor TB treatment responses, such as prolonged symptoms of infectiousness, treatment failure and death, and perhaps more importantly, the development of drug-resistant Mycobacterium tuberculosis. Given this, we think it is very important that population-specific pharmacokinetic norms be established for those for whom they are relatively unknown and whom make up the majority of cases in the TB epidemic today, mainly people living with HIV and AIDS and sub-Saharan Africans. And the emergence of extensively drug-resistant, or XDR TB, may indicate a pressing need to reassess the pharmacokinetic parameters of TB drugs worldwide and how they affect patient outcome, which is something that few studies to date have done. Given this, the objectives of our study were to determine the frequency of low serum levels of isoniazid, rifampin, ethambutol, and pyrazinamide among adults with TB in Botswana. We also sought to identify associations between patient risk factors and low drug levels, and to investigate associations between low drug levels and poor outcomes. This flowchart outlines our study methodology. All patients attending Habaroni Botswana's largest public outpatient clinic were invited to participate in the study if they were of age over 18 years or older, complained of cough for 2 or more weeks, had an abnormal chest X-ray, agreed to HIV testing, had a positive sputum AFB smear or mycobacterial culture, and had initiated TB treatment in the past 7 to 13 days. Those who gave consent were enrolled and then hospitalized, where they were kept fasting for at least 8 hours. After 8 hours or more of fasting, all 4 study drugs were administered simultaneously, and serum was drawn at 1, 2, and 6 hours after dosing. Specimens were then frozen and shipped to a U.S. laboratory that specializes in drug level analysis. Patients were then discharged and continued TB treatment on an outpatient basis. They were asked to return for clinical evaluations at 2, 6, 12, and 18 months after treatment initiation. For this study, we defined low maximum serum drug levels, or Cmax, using the previously published reference points listed here. We considered a patient to have had a poor treatment outcome if he or she had either treatment failure or had a death during treatment. We defined a treatment failure in one of 2 ways, having either a sputum that was positive after 6 months of treatment on AFB smear, or for those patients for whom 6-month smears were not done or not available, having no clinical improvement after 6 months of treatment. Our data analysis involved two steps. First, we performed a univariate analysis of risk factors versus our poor treatment outcome variable. Second, we performed a logistic regression of the poor treatment outcome variable against risk factors having a p-value less than 0.1 on our univariate analysis. And exact methods were used for cell sizes less than 5 patients. ...442 patients were screened for enrollment in the study. Of these, 192 were excluded because they did not meet one or more eligibility or exclusion criteria. Of the 250 patients enrolled, 25 were excluded from our final analysis because of missing data or non-TB growth on cultures. Therefore, our final sample size included 225 patients in the analysis. This table lists some of the important characteristics of those 225 patients. Of note, 69% were infected with HIV, and none of those living with HIV were taking antiretrovirals. The median CD4 count of all patients was 269 cells per microliter. However, among those who were infected with HIV, the median CD4 cell count was 189. Because of previous literature linking low TB drug levels with both HIV infection and degree of immunosuppression, I will be presenting data on drug levels and treatment outcomes stratified by both HIV infection status and CD4 count. A CD4 count of 200 was used as a cutoff because of its AIDS-defining significance, as well as because of its proximity to the median CD4 count of our HIV-infected population. No patient who was not HIV-infected had a CD4 count below 200. This table describes median Cmax values by HIV and CD4 status. Of note, Cmax values of both rifampin and pyrazinamide differed significantly by HIV and CD4 status. Applying the previously mentioned definitions, we found that considerable proportions of patients had low levels of TB drugs, particularly rifampin, ethambutol, and isoniazid. Additionally, among patients who were infected with HIV, those who had CD4 counts 200 or less were significantly more likely to have lower rifampin levels than those who had CD4 counts greater than or equal to 200. Similarly, the risk of death during treatment and overall poor treatment outcome were significantly higher among those who were both HIV infected and those with lower CD4 counts. Risk of treatment failure was not statistically significantly associated with HIV or CD4. After univariate analysis, three risk factors, being HIV infected, having a CD4 count less than 200, and having pyrazinamide low, were significantly associated with risk of poor treatment outcome. When these three risk factors were entered into our logistic model, only CD4 count less than 200 and pyrazinamide low remained significant. Looking more closely at pyrazinamide and individual treatment outcomes, low pyrazinamide was associated with both risk of treatment failure and a death during treatment, even after controlling for CD4 count and HIV infection status. There are both strengths and limitations to our study, which we acknowledge. Some strengths include that this was a prospective cohort study that had a relatively large sample size compared to other pharmacokinetic studies. However, there was a high mortality rate among our study population, and autopsies were not commonly performed in Botswana at this time. Additionally, pharmacokinetic testing was only performed once during our study, and we realized that the pharmacokinetic profiles of these patients may have changed as their health status has changed. So in conclusion, low TB drug levels occurred frequently in our study population, and immunosuppression was associated with some pharmacokinetic aberrations. Low pyrazinamide levels may increase the risk of both treatment failure and death during TB treatment. We are hopeful that future steps will include establishing TB drug pharmacokinetic norms for people living with HIV and AIDS, people of color, and women. And further investigation will be done as to pyrazinamide's role in TB treatment, the relationship of TB drug pharmacokinetics and acquired drug resistance, and antiretroviral effects on TB drug levels. Thank you very much.
Questions? How do you interpret the pyrazinamide results? And can you comment something about the Mycobacterium tuberculosis susceptibility pattern at baseline? They were, all the isolates were fully susceptible to the, mm-hmm. the first line TB drugs? Or?
No, that's that. Those are two great questions. Let me ask answer the second question first. We did do cultures on all of the patients, and all of those, the majority who were culture positive, we did do drug sensitivity testing. There were only two patients who had multi-drug resistance, isoniazid and rifampin, out of the whole cohort, and two additional patients who had mono-resistance to rifampin. Other than that, everyone was pan-susceptible. In regards to pyrazinamide's role, it was definitely very surprising for us to see these results, and we kept analyzing the data, trying to figure out, you know, whether we were confounding it in some way. But no matter how we analyzed it and cut it, pyrazinamide kept coming up as very significant, even though, oddly enough, the frequency of pyrazinamide being low is the lowest of all four medications. We're still not quite sure why it may be. My theory is that pyrazinamide, like isoniazid, really takes most of its strength from working in granulomas and more acidic environments, and that it may, when it's low, prevent TB, the mycobacterium, from really being eliminated throughout the body. And so people are more likely to continue being infectious and continue being sick if those, you know, acidic granulomas environments are not really sterilized. As to why pyrazinamide may be the key, other than that, I'm not quite sure. We are trying to figure out what other risk factors can predict pyrazinamide being low.
Okay. Hi, Mark Boyd from Australia. Just a couple of questions. One, you showed that, you know, PK parameters for some of the drugs clearly differed between HIV-infected people, particularly with low CD4.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't really get a feel for how drastically low those levels were as against, say, a generally accepted standard of what, you know, an accepted minimum would mm-hmm. be, and whether, in fact, the level was lower than that accepted minimum. The other question is, in terms of outcome, were these patients receiving TB dots or were they not?
Yes, they were all receiving TB dots. Directly observed, they were not getting packets of medications every week. They were actually getting it daily. In terms of how low is low, I am using definitions here, pharmacokinetic definitions, that were established starting in the 60s and that have been validated, but again, validated mainly on healthy people, not on people who actually are suffering with TB. These are the median values. The definitions, if you see here, you know, are below 3, below 8, below 2, and below 35. So most people were not horribly below, but by definition, they were low. There were some people who, you know, as you can see, had median levels or levels 1.3 instead of 3, so, you know, less than 50% of where it should be.
Hello, I'm Dr. Vijay Bhaskar Reddy from India. A quick question. Maybe I missed the point in your presentation. What was the duration of the treatment for tuberculosis?
6 months was standard treatment as part of the Botswana National TB Program guidelines. However, it was extended if the person had treatment failure or, you know, any other reason, any other circumstances. But 6 months was the typical.
For both HIV and non-HIV?
Yes.
And there was no difference?
No difference.
Gautam from Papua New Guinea. I saw one of the questions partly answered, and that was the TB, the DOT program. I was just wondering about it, compliance or adherence, firstly, and secondly, whether we're using fixed drug combination or non-fixed drug combination mm-hmm. for the TB drugs. Thanks.
These were not fixed drug combinations. These were individual meds, so four individual individually packaged meds, not combination pills. And these were medications that were quality assured by the Botswana National TB Program. In terms of, I'm sorry, I forgot your first question.
Adherence to the therapy.
Oh, adherence, yes. We looked at the number of doses of DOTS received during the study period between HIV infection, by HIV infection status, by CD4 count, and there was no significant difference. The median number of doses that were received was 186 doses.
Should we consider in the future TB treatment with higher doses of pyrazinamide?
I think for some of the medications, that would not be a bad idea. Those that have not been shown to have significant toxicity if you increase the doses, such as rifampin. For other medications, I think, it really needs to be taken into consideration, the balance between toxicity and improved efficacy. I think that it's a little bit more complex than just increasing the doses of these medications. I think we need to sort out why some of these people are having these pharmacokinetic aberrations and whether they actually are clinically significant. If you look at this, over 80% of people, regardless of their HIV infection status, had low rifampin levels, but we know that 80% of these people did not have poor treatment outcomes. So I don't think it's as cut and dried as looking at the levels. You know, what we want to kind of put out there for other researchers is maybe more observation and determination of pharmacokinetic parameters should be done so we can have a better, larger body of knowledge and evidence from which to base what's important and what's not.
So the question is concerning the definition of a poor outcome. You accept a poor outcome of TB when the patient developed a clinical deterioration, but you did not require microbiological confirmation of the of TB. So that the question is, how can you differentiate the poor outcome of TB as opposed to bad evolution of the HIV infection itself?
No, you're absolutely correct. I guess you mean in regards to the treatment failure, this second definition of treatment failure. We were torn about, you know, extending the definition of treatment failure to kind of a more clinical versus a laboratory definition. But I think we realized, and something I realized as a clinician myself, is that if you see someone coming into your clinic and they are still symptomatic in a way that potentially could be tuberculosis, but you don't know if it's tuberculosis or PCP or some other kind of, you know, community-acquired pneumonia, most likely that clinician or provider is going to treat the person as if they still have TB, and they're going to continue them on TB medications. And unfortunately, most providers in Botswana don't have the luxury of doing, you know, laboratory confirmation every time a patient comes in and they're not better. So this is mainly a clinical definition based on what we thought the providers would do if a patient like this came in.
Thank you.
We don't have time for more questions. We will move to the next.
Okay.
Thank you very much. The last presentation is mortality associated with tuberculosis in HIV positive and negative patients in the heart era in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, and it will be presented by Dr. Arroyo. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm glad to be here and to present you the results of our study, Mortality Associated with Tuberculosis in HIV-positive and HIV-negative patients in the heart era in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. The objectives of our study were to compare tuberculosis mortality between HIV-positive and negative patients and to analyze variables associated with tuberculosis death. This is a prospective cohort study conducted at Tuberculosis Referral Center at Fiocruz from January 2000 to August 2006. Follow-up was censored 1 year after the end of tuberculosis therapy. The inclusion criteria were to have a positive culture for mycobacterium tuberculosis, start anti-tuberculosis therapy, and to agree to participate in the study. anti-tuberculosis and anti-retroviral therapies followed the national recommendation. In naive patients, HART was initiated at least 30 days after tuberculosis therapy. Multiple drug resistance was defined as resistant at least to rifampicin and isoniazid, and tuberculosis-associated death were considered when they occur during tuberculosis therapy and no other causes were identified. For the statistical analysis, HIV-positive and negative covariables were compared using the Key-Square and Fisher-ISAC tests. Survival analysis were performed by Kaplan-Meier survival curves and compared by the log-rank test. From the date of tuberculosis diagnosis until death or sensory date, with a maximum of 24 months follow-up. In the Cox proportional hazard regression, HART was modeled as a time-dependent covariate. Variables with p-values below 20% were selected for the multivariate regression. The final model retained variables with p-value below 10%. Demographic and epidemiological data showed that age was significantly higher in the HIV-negative group. In other variables like gender, alcohol abuse, drug use, and monthly income were not. Clinical data show a significant difference between HIV-positive and negative groups according to tuberculosis clinical forms, treatment interruption due to adverse events, rifampicin use up to the end of therapy, and abandon of tuberculosis therapy. Baseline laboratory data showed that positive blood cultures were significantly more prevalent in the HIV-positive group, as well as resistant to rifampicin and MDR-TB. CD4 counts and viral load are shown for the HIV-positive group closer to TB diagnosis. HART regimens used during tuberculosis treatment are presented in this slide. And the more prevalent regimens included efavirenz and ritonavir-saquinavir. In terms of follow-up and endpoints, the length of follow-up was similar in both groups, but crude and tuberculosis-associated mortality were significantly higher in the HIV-positive group. Although, surprisingly, loss of follow-up was higher in the HIV-negative group. Survival in the HIV-negative group was significantly longer than in HIV-positive. Survival in the HART group became closer to HIV-negative group than the group that did not receive HART. However, comparing only the HART group with the HIV-negative group, we still remark a significant difference on survival. The univariate time-dependent Cox regression analysis, the risk of death of the HART group lost its significance, and is remarkable the hazard ratio of the HIV group without HART. The risk of tuberculosis death, according to the studied variables, showed that disseminated tuberculosis, mycobacteremia, and lack of rifampicin use were associated with a higher risk of death. The risk of death was also significantly higher among groups that presented resistance to rifampicin and severe adverse reaction, although multi-drug resistance and abandon of TB therapy were not associated with a significant risk of death. Other variables associated with a risk of death were HIV-positive group with CD4 counts below 200 and with an AIDS-defining criterion based on other opportunistic diseases. The final model of the multivariate Cox regression analysis showed that lack of heart during tuberculosis therapy and disseminated TB were associated with a significant higher mortality. In conclusion, despite the free access of heart in Brazil, tuberculosis mortality is still significantly higher in the HIV-positive group than in the HIV-negative. Variables associated with a higher risk of death were disseminated TB, resistant to rifampicin, and lack of rifampicin and heart during tuberculosis therapy. The analysis comparing HIV-positive on heart and HIV-negative patients is still not conclusive. We thank all patients that agreed to participate in this study and to all health professionals involved. We also thank the Ministry of Science and Technology, Millennium One, Brazilian TB Network, and PAPIS 3 Fiocruz for the financial support. Thank you very much for your attention.
Questions?
I am Dr. Divakar Tejasvi from India. I have two questions. One is that you told that heart was initiated after 30 days of TB therapy starting. So it was universal, or it was, what was the rationale of using 1 month, whether it was CD4 dependent or something like that? So you started heart treatment universally after 30 days for all the patients. And second, whether in your national program, whether there is without rifampicin treatment protocol also to be followed, like you told that without rifampicin this was the case like.
For the first question, we initiate heart after 30 days of therapy for naive patients, because in our experience and in the literature, we see that if we put the heart at the same time of TB therapy, adverse events are very frequent. So we wait at least 30 days. This is our experience too. So that's why we do that. But it, just for naive patients, for previously treated patients, we just change the PI that is involved in heart. And the first question, I don't remember.
Second, this was the first, that whether it was CD40. And second is whether without rifampicin is also your national program.
Yes, we have in our program, the first line is with rifampicin, but sometimes you cannot use rifampicin. So we have an optional regimen without rifampicin that includes streptomycin and ethambutol, because our guidelines in Brazil, we use three drugs to treat TB, rifampicin, isoniazid, and parenzanamide only. We have a very low incidence of multidrug resistant TB. That's why we use three drugs.
David Cohn from the United States. Your baseline rate of MDR in the HIV positives was a little bit surprising.
Yeah.
Do you have an explanation as to why? Were these prior patients previously treated, exposed in the hospital? Any other explanation as to why that was the case in a cohort study?
We are performing a new investigation about resistance in Brazil, because the data we have is 10 years old, you know? So we are looking to see what is happening now. But this result was also surprising for us, because normally we believed that it was similar for both groups. Maybe it is the casuistic, but, you know, we are a referral center, so we receive patients for all over Rio de Janeiro and not in a special site. So we have to look forward to this. These are the first results of our study. So maybe with more patients we can see what happened next. Thank you.
Mark Boyd, Australia. Two questions. One, What determines in your guidelines, or at least in your institution, which patients should receive antiretrovirals when being treated for TB? And the second is, in this analysis, I may have missed this, was this all primary TB, or were some of these patients having recurrent episodes? And if so, how did you control for that in the analysis?
Yes, there are patients that were naive for the first TB in their lives, but there was also patients that had lots of TB, because in Brazil, TB is very huge, and Rio de Janeiro is a city that has the hugest incidence of tuberculosis. So we have mixed patient, naive patients for TB and no naive patients. My memory is not very good, so I don't remember the other question you made. Can you
just repeat? Just the guidelines for initiating antiretroviral therapy in patients requiring rifampicin-based TB therapy.
Yes, we have a guideline, and we use HART for patients with less than 350 CD4 counts. And because we are an endemic area, we are very... we have caution, because sometimes even with CD4 counts of 350, we made a viral load to see what happened with this viral load, and we make that 15 days after starting TB therapy, not to be biased by the viral load of TB itself.
I'm Dr. Vijayabhaskar Reddy again. You had a few patients who were taking efavirenz-based regimen, and also a few on nevirapine. The numbers were quite small. Did you see any difference in outcomes of HIV treatment in these people?
Yes, we saw that in another article. And in fact, for naive patients, efavirenz-based regimen works better, because the side effects are less. But for experienced patients, efavirenz normally doesn't work very well. So ritonavir and saquinavir were better, and also are better tolerated for experienced patients than for naive. So we use both, but we prefer for naive patients efavirenz-based regimens, and for the patient in failure for the first-line regimen, antiretroviral, we use efavirenz at first line regimen. So we put ritonavir and saquinavir, and we hope we can find another drug to combine with rifampicin to do it better.
Short question, please.
Spiros Miyakis from Sydney, Australia. I found very interesting that you showed that the patients that stopped rifampicin did worse. So have you gone any further to analyze this data? Because that was due to discontinuation, due to interactions after they started HART, or due to intolerance, or what?
Yes, that lots of reasons. First is intolerance. It's very frequent in an HIV-positive with low CD4 counts to have intolerance. And sometimes we have to stop therapy and reintroduce drug to drug. And sometimes we receive a test of sensibility. There is a resistance, so we have to change. That's why I said people that use rifampicin all over the therapy and not for the first 30 days or 60 days. But this casuistic is still small for HIV-positive patient, because our inclusion criteria was to have a positive culture. And we have a lot of patients, but a confirmed TB, it was like that. So we believe really rifampicin is a very important drug. And we don't have rifabutin in Brazil. It's very expensive. And rifampicin is given by the Ministry of Health and works very, very well, as I have shown.
I have a question. Most of the mortality most of the mortality in other studies when people start antiretroviral therapy with tuberculosis occurs very early on, And the argument is generally made that maybe people have come in too late for treatment and might even be a reason to institute therapy earlier. You start at 30 days, but I'd be interested to know what proportion of patients actually, when they died in relationship to antiretroviral therapy and TB, it looked like the Kaplan-Meier-Savarro curves looked like death continued over the entire course. But what proportion died in, let's say, the first three months?
In fact, most of that occurred at the first month,
right.
Even the first 30 days. That's why we made a time-dependent covariate for therapy. And in fact, they arrive and die.
Yeah.
So even if you give antiretroviral, maybe they die quicker because lots of side effects and... That's a decision to make that really is not very good, because sometimes we want to put the therapy very early to prevent that. And in fact, you have to interrupt all therapies, and tuberculosis is our priority. We have to treat tuberculosis because they die of tuberculosis more than AIDS. So in Brazil, we have been working like that since the year 2000. And we believe, we really believe that it works better in that way. We don't know exactly what is the point, the best point to start antiretroviral therapy. But we do like that.
Right. Well, it does get to the issue, which is a pertinent issue that everyone is interested in, that is what is the golden moment to start antiretroviral therapy in people with TB. So your patients did die early on. And the question still, I think, is open as to whether the starting point for antiretroviral therapy should be moved closer, even in the face of toxicity and other concerns, given that the mortality is early on, and whether that should be some of the debate that comes out of this data, actually, as to either trying to answer that question in Brazil or consideration of earlier starting of therapy in very sick patients.
Is there any other question? Yeah,
yes.
Last question.
Perhaps just, it's a general question and perhaps slightly tangential, but perhaps best addressed to the speaker, but also to the panel. To what extent is isoniazid preventative therapy or any preventative therapy being used in the national guidelines of each, particularly in Brazil, but also other people on the panel might want to comment? Is it used at all?
Yes, our guidelines recommend the use of rifampicin for all HIV-positive patients infected by Mycobacterium tuberculosis. So it's a standard of care. When we see a patient HIV-positive for the first time, we have to test them and to use isoniazid to prevent TB. But you know, exogenous reinfection in an endemic area is a huge problem. So we are making a study to see how long we can live without TB using isoniazid at the beginning of HIV infection.
So in this cohort, did many of these people actually break through isoniazid preventative therapy, or were most of them not taking isoniazid?
It prevents, yes. There is a new article that has been published by Cavalcante Solange that show that a heart itself is able to reduce the risk of tuberculosis, but if you give isoniazid, you reduce very much, as high as 70%. So you can prevent very, very much the incidence of TB.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. We are on time. On behalf of Dr. Freeland and myself, we would like to thank all the speakers for their excellent presentations and to all of you for your attention to this important meeting. Thank you very much.